Hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies. For over 30 years, Trakel has been obsessed with the art of brushmaking, and now they're applying that same obsession to professional-grade artist panels. Both their brushes and panels are made right here in California at their Hesperia factory. Go to Trakel.com and use promo code SAVVY16 to get 15% off your next order. My guest today is Ginny Gardner. Ginny graduated from Cornell University with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in 1974. And in 2005, she moved upstate to Catskill, New York, where she and her husband renovated and restored the former Lyceum, a federal-era building in the historic village. In this episode, Ginny talks about her early career in the music video industry and how the layered style of those videos informs her thought process and her current collage and painting. Ginny's work is heavily influenced by colorist Joseph Albers and Johan Zitten. As she will describe, she plays with what she calls equivalent palettes. She creates a small collage, or maybe does a thumbnail color study, which are typically just a few inches square. And these are meant to work out broad issues in design and color before she starts on a large painting. Ginny then translates the collages into large-scale paintings, some as large as 8 feet. By looking at her work, you can tell that Ginny has a solid grip on color and how to use it effectively. And if you are at all familiar with Albers and Ittens, you will immediately see how she plays with their theories. Also, Ginny shares her favorite books on art, which of course I love, being the book geek that I am. Those books, by the way, are listed in the show notes on savvypainter.com. Okay, let's get to it. Here is Ginny Gardner. Hey, Ginny, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast with me. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
It was my pleasure, Antrice, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Can you tell me a little bit about when you started off as a painter? What made you decide to make it your vocation and be a professional painter versus a hobbyist, for example?
Well, that's a good question. Growing up, I was always drawing and painting since I can remember, since I was 5 years old. I grew up in a household with my stepmother was a watercolor teacher, a Pratt graduate. So I grew up with paints around, and she had unused oil paints that she wasn't interested in using. So that was a great boon to me because I didn't want watercolors. I liked the oil paints. I was already kind of messing around with oil paints when I was in high school. It just seemed like just a part of my life completely. I was always making, I didn't call them collages at the time, but I was doing a lot of work in my personal scrapbooks and stuff, always drawing, cutting, painting, you know, making portraits of friends, cutting them out, pasting those onto other things I was doing in school. I mean, it was just part of my life. So, and everybody said I had quote unquote talent, but you know, when you're a kid, you're kind of like, you almost feel like a monkey if you're doing like, now Ginny, you'll draw a picture, that kind of thing.
So I was yes.
a little squeamish about all that. But I realized it was the one thing that made me feel centered. It really was the one thing in my life that made me feel relaxed. I loved always being around with a sketchbook. And so I just said to myself, you know, I should give myself a chance. And I applied to, when I had my basically review, you had to do a portfolio to get into Cornell University's Fine Arts Department, Architecture, Art, and Planning. So I basically spent a few months preparing Raphael drawings and really, really classical studies of folds and drapes and everything else. I wanted to show my drafting and a lot of portrait work and stuff. So I took it very seriously, and I was glad when I got in because it was a good studio course at Cornell. But I made a decision pretty much around, I'd say, 2021, that was going to be my direction. You know, so it was never a difficult choice, but I took it very seriously. I didn't realize how much I really needed it until, I think, my early 20s. When I grew up, I just assumed I did it.
Right.
It's interesting how that happens. Things happen in life, and you find out that one aspect of it is giving you some pure like enjoyment where you're just not thinking about the time and you're able to give. I think what it is for a young person is If you're not bored, I mean, if you really, really can dive into that for hours at a time, you're probably pretty serious about it. But I don't think you know that when you're a child yet. You know, I think it takes some hindsight to see that those are the times when you're the most real to yourself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I actually hadn't thought of that particularly because when you're a child or when you're young, it's easier for you to get lost in things, I think. Maybe possibly because you don't have the same responsibilities that you do as an adult. You have more time on your hands.
Yeah, there's more of a play aspect.
Yeah.
So I think younger people, you're playing, making art, so you're not aware of that quality until you have to do all these other things when you get older. And then you discover, if you're an artist, I think you discover that playfulness is just something that you miss. And it's actually quite serious because then you're starting to actually figure out what you like to do, what you like to look at. So it's quite an amazing process.
It is. And just that whole concept that it's something that, like you alluded to, that you really need, that without it, you're not a whole person.
Yeah. I mean, I found when I was just taking the courses at Cornell stuff, I really needed for the first couple of years to have a sketchbook with me practically all the time. Because I could be sitting in a coffee shop or listening to a music event or something, and I would just sit there and sketch my friends and, you know, my surroundings. And I realized it gave me a sense of importance, you know what I mean? A sense of like, I can do this. I'm communicating.
Right.
You know, in other areas were just like, of course, Cornell was difficult. I mean, the course requirements were difficult and everything else. I'm glad I went to a full, you know, arts and sciences background kind of school, but this was the one that I felt my most empowered, where I was actually able to communicate something different from anybody else. I think at a young age, I sort of realized what differentiates us from everybody else. When you look at all the things we all deal with, it's all the same kind of things.
Right.
The one thing that's really separates us is the studio, is the art. I think whether it's, you know, a musician or a painter or a sculptor. The other thing that was kind of interesting in that period of time when Cornell was great, and we can talk more about, you know, earlier years, but I remember at the time, though, the early 70s, I graduated in 74, painting was not that popular. You know, it was mainly performance art.
Mm-hmm.
A video artist. A lot of our friends were video artists, or they were performance artists, or, you know, writers, anything but a painter. Painting was not, you know, the popular thing.
It was old school, right? Because, I mean, at that time, if you think about it, video artists would be the equivalent of what we call new media artists now, where it's dealing with the new technology, if you want to put it that way. It seems funny to call video new technology, but at that time it was, right?
Yeah, and it was sort of, and people say to me, oh, Ginny, why don't you want to do something faster? Why would you want to just paint? That's too slow, and there's all of that. And, you know, it's interesting because I never thought of it that way. I always felt that drawing was a great gift, you know, and a great tool, and I still believe that. And it kind of was born out in those years when in my 20s, in graduating from Cornell, some of the early jobs I had, one of them was with a video production company. And this was after I also, another job was running an arts program in the 70s for the federal arts program to find artist jobs, looking at their portfolios and giving advice, which was kind of amazing for a young woman in her 20s. Here I am talking 40 years old, and I said, this is awful. I've got to get back into the studio because, you know, you have to have a lot of humility talking to people who have careers and you're trying to give them advice at such a young
age. I'd imagine, yes.
But the interesting job that kind of bridged, because you brought up, I witnessed the whole transition into the age of digital.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, because in the early 80s, I was running my own little business called Artwork, and I worked with all the ad agencies doing TV storyboards. So I work with artists and create the animatics and the photomatics and all the things that were kind of test commercials so that an agency could win an account. So I work with a couple of artists. And a company called Charlex, a video company, hired me to be a producer because I could take flat art and animate it.
Mm-hmm.
And this video company, video production company in New York, after Cornell, of course, I went down to New York for work, so that's where I was. We started getting digital coming in. We were working on some of the early music videos for MTV. And
oh, wow.
Everything was translating into the digital world where we had, you know, Ampex digital optics and everything. So it was a whole revolution. I mean, to go through that was, you have no idea. It was so mind-boggling.
I bet. Yeah, because I'm actually old enough to remember MTV when it very first started and how revolutionary and amazing that was and some of the videos that were happening. And
the Pause You Might Think video, that was the company that I was with.
What was it called?
Cars, the music group.
Oh, did you really?
You Might Think video. That was all.
Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, it was called the Charlex kind of cut and paste look. So I was one of the producers there, and we were working with art, live action, you know, all of these layering in all of these elements. And that had a very, very big influence on my development as a painter.
How so?
Well, I left Charlex, was back in the studio, and they asked me back again. So there was a sort of a drift in and out, in, you know, back and forth between my my studio. I had a painting studio in Chelsea in the West 20s for many years until we moved upstate here about 10 years ago. But I felt the need to really be back in the studio. I left after working pretty intensely for a year in 1984 and 85 and 86 back in the studio. And then I went back into Charlex for another year. And then I basically quit to paint full time. But the influence was, it came not in the beginning, in the early 80s, in the early to mid 80s and late 80s, I was working in a sort of a modernist, large, very, very glass, reflective surfaces, very kind of wanting to really develop a lot of color.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kept on wanting to get back to the figure. And I think pictorially, I don't think about real space. I think about my own pictorial space, probably from my whole background of being sort of a design element of where all the elements will fit into this unified whole.
Mm-hmm.
So like the early video layering influence, I started inserting figures just from, you know, fashion or historical figures into my actual setups in the studio, into glass and painted backgrounds and things. And I started creating my own kind of animated maquettes. So I've been working basically since the late 80s and early 90s from maquettes. I work everything, all my paintings are based on smaller studies. They're either photo montages, photography of mine where I've maybe used other elements or incorporated painted areas with photographs, et cetera. But I'm always creating a montage or collage in order to work from it so that I can mix the oil paints from the studies. I don't paint directly from life. So it's a little different. And it really was an influence, the video layering, working with different elements, keying things, seeing how things relate, seeing how they're
right,
juxtaposing. So it's kind of a hybrid working method, a little different. I never wanted to just do this sort of National Academy kind of thing where there's a figure sitting on the stool. You know, I did a lot of that in high school, you know, just painting from life and stuff.
Right.
And it just wasn't, it wasn't my voice. It's not the way, when I see a painting, it's much more of a pictorial kind of space, not painting the landscape directly.
Well, I think that step that you're talking about that you went through in high school of painting directly from life is sort of, you know, I always say that gives you the vocabulary.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It gives you the words as you increase your skill level. In that sense, you're effectively increasing your vocabulary. And then at some point, you need to learn how to use it to communicate your own story and to tell your own story, right? So then you're able to, the more vocabulary you have from that, you're able to do what you're doing, you know, like creating these different pictorial images.
That's exactly right. And at Cornell too, I mean, there was really, really, really good drawing professors. I mean, you interviewed Jillian Peterson Craig,
mm-hmm.
wonderful drawing professor. And there were several others at the time, and we had a pretty rigorous drawing in our workshops, you know, for several hours, two or three times a week, drawing from the model, drawing from setups, still life setups, drawing from just some single objects, you know, having to draw it, make it perfect. So the drawing, I'm so glad I had that. working everything from gestural drawing on large newsprint pads to really, really fine pencil drawings, ink, all aspects of it. And also at Cornell, I studied printmaking with a really good printmaking professor there, Stephen Pileski, who was quite wonderful in the silkscreen department. But there were other areas, aquatint, lithography, block printing, all of that's just wonderful, especially in terms of aquatint for tonal massing, you know, all of those ways to approach a graphic image. I think it's the more you can do with any of it, the better, because it really comes in later, comes in handy later. Like when I think about the silkscreen work I did, it's just kind of it's come in the last 10 years. I did a lot of trompe l'oeil painting over in the 90s, but in the last, I'd say, since moving upstate, my palette has become more reductive, and it's more about really, really specific pieces of color, shapes of color, but each one is plainer. And I think some of that comes from the silkscreen experience.
Yeah, so as we're talking, I'm sitting here, I'm listening intently, but I'm also staring at your work. And I can, you know, like everything that you're saying, I can really see how that layering and pulling pieces together, especially knowing about the Cars video and screen tinting and all of that is, I can definitely see it now. It's really interesting to hear you talk about that and to be staring at your work.
It's interesting, yeah, because it also brought into play early studies at Cornell, and now it's been a lifelong. I just revere Joseph Albers.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Homage to the Square.
Uh huh.
I went and saw a couple years ago at the Morgan Library in Manhattan on 35th Street, a beautiful little exhibit. I've always loved Joseph Albers' work. This was an opportunity to actually see each Homage to the Square painting. You know, there were a large number of them, beautifully all small. And Therese, you go into these spaces, and it wasn't a very popular show, so hardly anyone was there, which is really great in New York City.
Yes. I've never seen his work in person. My heart would just be all aflutter.
The colors pulsated. Yeah, each square, you could see the colors, and you could just see what he was doing with the shapes. And it was such an inspiration, because one of the things that I always found as an oil painter much more interesting than, say, watercolor for me personally, is it's an opaque medium. So you're mixing colors. And just like with Albers, if you want to show that something, one plane is behind another plane, if you're mixing opaque colors in order to affect a look of transparency. So that mastery that he had has been a great influence on my development, because I've said that's what I'm going to do, to study the optical aspects of color so that I can master them and the color will create the plane.
Yes.
And it's just, once you get into really thinking about that when you're mixing your colors and or other aspects of color, it becomes endless. You know, you're never bored, because you're thinking, and you're also thinking about structuring the painting through these interlocking or knitted together pieces of color, and it becomes just a fascination in and of itself, regardless of the subject matter, you know.
Right.
You know, it's just like, hey, this is exciting. This is keying. This is keying together. So he was a great influence on me in that regard, in terms of just my enjoyment of a studio practice, because you don't feel so much in like the search or a need. Like, you don't worry so much about your subject.
Yeah.
You
just
a take on a lot of different things if you have an approach to your material.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was just talking to another artist and we were talking about, does it feel repetitive when you paint the same or a similar subject repeatedly? And, you know, I kind of mentioned, and I don't know why I didn't think of Joseph Albers, but for me also huge influence and something that I just latched onto when I was in my college years. And I was using the example that I'm really interested in glaciers right now. And I've done the same, you know, from very similar reference standpoint, almost the same painting in terms of the structure of it. But every time I've done it probably 10 times, you know, either tiny or large or whatever. But what's been the most fascinating to me is those color challenges of, can I paint this glacier that has these really intense blues in it without any blue in it, just by manipulating the colors around it. And can I, you know, like how, and that will keep me occupied. I don't know how, like, I'm still not bored. I've done it 10 times. I will do it again.
That's the approach where that really harkens right back to another early influence who I just think he's profound in that regard, just the aspect you're talking about of exactly what is the local color, because it's never like what people think of blue, they think of glacier blue, you know, and as painters, we, especially as colorists, we know that that's not the case. It's always, it's relativity. Charles Hawthorne, great teacher, you know, seeing notes of color, basically with your eye. Early on, I did this after Cornell. I went and studied. I had a job. My first job was in a photo lab, and I went looking around. I was a manager of a photography lab, and I had to interact between the union and the public, and I really had to get my hands on paint when I got out of work at the end of the day.
Oh, yes.
Somebody to kind of study with for a year to keep it going, because things were so dry in New York in terms of, you know, it was a recession going on and nobody cared about painting. I just had to keep my wits about me, you know, doing something in a little room in my apartment, the little studio set up. So I found a man named, very, very sweet older man, Arthur Stern was his name. And I'd go after work and he taught basically the Hawthorne school. Like, we do setups and I would just paint with a palette knife with a couple of other people. And we would do really simple setups, you know, with just in boxes at night.
Yep.
Just a combination in incandescent and fluorescent light to equivocate daylight as best we could. And with a palette knife and just a limited palette, you know, we say 10 colors, you know, you get 10 mixtures to create this. And I did that for about 3 or 4 evenings a week for about a year, just as a, as a really rigorous color study, you know, with not the drawing, forgetting the drawing, because you're just going in with a knife. And Antrese, you could make the most, when you do it that many hours and you're mixing and mixing, mixing, you can make the most beautiful statements just with a knife on an 8x10 little canvas pad. And I found that to be really liberating, because it made me feel I could have a take on, I had done a lot of painting at Cornell, a lot of figure, a lot of still life and some landscape. And this got me back sort of even more purely to, first and foremost, it's a pictorial space. It's composed of color on this surface. So this is where you start. And it was very satisfying, you know, in the sense that you really don't need that much.
Right.
And its works would get more complicated and less complicated over the years. But I think it's like with your glacier, you know, if you find out what you like, it's you're so gratified, you know, it can be something as simple, like I've discovered that I really do like that. One of the reasons I had a whole couple years love affair with Tiepolo, starting in like 1998, Gian Battista Tiepolo, you know, who knew, you know, here he is like 1900s guy. And I'm saying, why is this work exciting me so much? Well, with all these draperies and folds, like Wissenberg, you know, this whole processional, beautiful figures. And I realized that the figures and the drapes, like I liked the drapery and the folds and the shapes and the figures and the way they were all intertwining, and the way the figure could be the drapery, the elbow could be the pole. I mean, everything was so about just the love of the paint.
Right.
I did this whole series of Tiepolo-based paintings, the same montage coming out of the glass and then the kind of pop figural thing. I started weaving in these Tiepolo elements, and I actually had several solo shows in 2000 based on the Tiepolo theme, because he was just, I realized that's, I really love that. And it's funny because the things that you're drawn to, they keep coming up. They come up
right
in different ways. Like right now, I'm just starting a series. It's just, you can see some collage studies. I just brand new in the last few months of just, you know, my husband's shirt and a tie, and he's got a book.
It's so funny. I'm looking at one right now. And as you're talking, I'm just like, probably because we're talking about Joseph Albers, but the one that I'm looking at, he's got an orange you know, on the book is an orange page, but you can, like, I just keep staring at the shadow of his arm on his shirt and the reflection back of the orange into his shadow. And it's so subtle and so beautifully done.
Thank you. And see, that's the study. So that's so exciting because I have that study, you know, which was basically a very simplified form, cut out, basically creating a background that works with the shirt, with the tie, with the shadows, you know, with the hand. And it's this one, so it's a group of about 8 or 9 collage studies, and I've got the paintings started now in the studio. So
these are painting or collages?
These are collages, and I basically, they're my photography and painted backgrounds that I've designed. So these are my studies.
Okay.
For the paintings. So what I do is I do a very reductive, I create the study that I will use to mix my pigments from.
Uh-huh.
So there's the design aspect, you know, in terms of having a small format that I then work into my larger paintings. So if you look at on my website, there's a, in some of the download, the catalog downloads, you see there's one, it's called Equivalent Palettes. If you see that and look at it, it shows you the collages next to the finished paintings. It's kind of interesting.
I see it now. Okay, wait. Okay, and so for people who are listening, if anybody's doing what I'm doing, which is literally talking, if you're listening and you're like, what is she talking about? It's at jinnygardner.com, and I'll link to that on the webpage. But if you're listening to this and want to pull this up on your phone, it's jinnygardner.com.
And you can see that I pretty much, so I'm not painting the color. I'm not standing outside and saying, what color is that? I'm working on these studies, and I don't start a painting unless I look at the study and say, I see a painting. In other words,
right.
I can see that in oil paint. That's the design. That's the drive. That's the kind of goal. You're trying to create a pictorial space that makes me want to paint it. So in those are successful, in my opinion. They're successful as paintings when I'm looking at them, due to the design work I did on them pretty intensely before starting the painting. So that's very satisfying. And you can do,
yeah,
you can do that with any kind of subject matter. I mean, you can create a study, and it probably goes way, way, way back to teachers that used to teach very formalistically. I'm thinking of some artists I've known that are now in their 80s or that worked in very, very formal teaching in terms of doing thumbnail, you know, thumbnail drawing.
Yes.
And just getting a little, your ideas, you know, just get the few shapes and strokes and stuff so you go, yeah, you know, so you have something. And I think that, I mean, I'm glad that I've sort of been formed by that, because one thing I'm not that fond of is just like too much mashing in of information. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I like to feel like there's an entrance into a painting. There's a way, there's a take. I like to see a take.
Yeah, I think like you're alluding to, you haven't really come out and said it yet, but I'm just wondering, like for me, like those little, so I was trained also to do those little thumbnails, and I love those just for the sake of doing those. I still will do them all the time of just, you know, like 3 inch by 4 inch and either master copies or my own work or whatever. But you can't help but see the bigger picture of the design, like you're alluding to. And then you can go on and kind of riff from there or go free from there when you're doing the larger painting. But you solve all the big major problems because you can't get detailed in those tiny little pieces, which is the point of them.
Exactly. Exactly. And also in the beauty of it is that you get a better sense of scale.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to work large and small. I really believe that. You can make a very, very big, small painting. You know, I've seen some paintings that are 4 by 5 inches that are just have incredible scale. Because one of the things I remember going way back, you know, when I was just starting to like, oh my gosh, you know, I did this, you know, I want to make this oil painting. And when you're young and you're going, I'm going to make it 2 by 3 feet or 3 by 4 feet. And it's like, whoa, you know, this is a big statement.
Right.
To deal with issues of scale, I think earlier on, and just confront it and deal with it is a lot better than either just doing really huge work or just saying, well, I only work really small. I think it's great if you can think about translating, you know, how would this translate? And if you can see the kinds of adjustments you have to do from small to large, because it does happen.
Yeah.
That's why I call it equivalent palettes. Like when I work from a small study to a larger scale painting, there's always adjustments. And also you're in different mediums, which I find really totally fascinating. What's an equivalent? When I'm thinking of equivalent colors and I'm mixing them, you've got such a range of pigments. It's really interesting which one gives the buzz.
Yeah.
Because you can get to a color a lot of different ways. And that's a whole endless subject, but it is endless.
Yeah, which is why it's so fascinating and why you can stay on this for decades easily.
I think that that's the beauty, you know, because as you get more mature, you can find, it's interesting, I've seen this of artists all my life, and now I'm seeing it happen to me too, as I'm, you know, a mature artist now. You want to do more with less, you know, you say, wait, you know, I don't need this. I don't, you know, I used to let in a lot more extraneous detail and just think I had to deal with it. And I think you become more, no, I don't need that. I just need this. I'm just going to work with this. I think you become more selective. Maybe it's a confidence. Maybe it's a sense of relaxation in knowing kind of what you're looking for.
It seems to me that it's a sort of confidence. And I'm constantly making analogies between painting and music or painting and writing. But in this case, to me, it feels like what you're describing is sort of like a beginning writer who uses a lot of words because they've learned a big vocabulary. So it's almost like they want to use all of them. And then as writers mature, they can say the same thing with 5 words as they used to say with 40 words.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's probably more accurate.
Yeah. I so admire great writers. I love to read. I have an amazing book collection and I just love reading. I'm not a writer. I can write expository. I love reading really good writing about painting. I mean, that has been just as much of an inspiration for me as other painters. I mean, there's many other painters that have been a great inspiration to me. But also writers that can, like, talking about Tiepolo, a book that I read was called Tiepolo and the Pictorial Intelligence. It was written by Svetlana Albers and Michael Baxendahl.
Mm-hmm.
Read it like in 1997, 98. And the writing was so moving. And talking about pictorial intelligence and about how the painter, how he evolved. I mean, it was an incredible inspiration to me as a painter. It just got me so excited about being an artist, I know, all over again. And you can find writers like that.
This episode is sponsored by Trakel Art Supplies. For over 30 years, Trakel has been obsessed with the art of brushmaking. Trakel sells directly to artists, and they do that so they can keep their quality high and their costs low. Both their brushes and panels are made right here in California at their Hesperia factory. Brian Trakel is the founder of Trakel Art Supplies. I asked him what he recommends artists do to keep their brushes longer.
Well, probably one of the most funny things is when people find out I'm a brush maker, they'll pull up some Grumbacher brush that they've had for 30 years, and it's worn down to a nub, and they say this is the greatest thing they have, and they're still using it. I always get a kick out of that, but if you want to make a brush last, you've got to take care of it, and that means you've got to clean it. And quite often, that's where people have trouble, is that they just don't clean it well enough, and it builds up, and it destroys the filaments, or it makes it bush out, and it just makes it work improperly. If they want them to last forever and ever, take really good care of them. But depending on what you're painting on, it's going to wear out the brush. That's another thing that people need to be able to recognize, that the brush has its useful life and it's time to get another one. You're going to notice at some point in time that it's just not giving you the result you think you should be getting out of it.
Go to Trakel.com and use promo code SAVVY16 to get 15% off your next order. I'm fanatical about reading. Like, I could be locked in a library for the rest of my life, and I'd probably be pretty content, I think. So I'm curious, what authors or what books, aside from that one, would you recommend?
Well, just in terms of just general reading along the lines of fine art, or just in general reading?
Let's start in terms of fine art. I might ask you more later.
Well, in terms of fine art, I really like, he's written on some of my work and stuff. I love the writings of Carter Ratcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's fabulous. He's written some major monographs on artists, everyone from John Singer Sargent to Andy Warhol to Alex Katz. He's a wonderful writer on artists. I would highly recommend him. I also really like David Saul's writing.
I don't know if I've read him.
Yeah, he really writes really, really well on artists. He's a painter himself, and he writes really well on artists. There's a woman artist, I'm trying to remember her name right now. There's a woman who writes on, she writes on women portrait painters. I'd have to look it up. But I liked the writings on other women artists, you know, and how this particular book is great, point blank. Frances Borzello, B-O-R-Z-E-L-L-O. And she wrote A World of Our Own, Women as Artists.
So like a room of one's own.
And she's great. And then another book I'm reading right now is, I'm really enjoying it, The Bauhaus Group by Nicholas Fox Weber.
Okay.
Six Masters of Modernism. He's really good, Nicholas Fox Weber. He's written several artists. He's written about Le Corbusier and Balthus. And he's written about patron saints, about the Wadsworth Athenaeum people. I mean, just, he's really fascinating.
I'm making my Christmas list now as we're talking.
And then there's really good writers on collage. One writer I enjoy is Brandon Taylor, B-R-A-N-D-O-N-T-A-Y-L-O-R. He's collage, the making of modern art. But there's so many good writers.
Yeah.
I find every day I'm always just going over to my library and grabbing a book here and there and just reading a piece here and there. I do that sometimes before starting painting in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Just because, you know, it's so great just to get immersed in the practice, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I like this question because, I don't know, I read this book a long time, years ago, but I love it about, I think it's called The Daily Habits of Artists, but something really close to that. But somebody basically went back and researched all these different artists, and included in that are obviously painters, but writers and filmmakers and, you know, like kind of the whole spectrum of the arts, and was trying to figure it out, their daily rituals and what they did and how much time they actually spent creating art. So I love the fact that, you know, at least sometimes you start your day by reading about other artists. Do you have a daily ritual or something that you always do, but when you go into your studio or to start off your creative time?
Well, I like to, first of all, put on some music. Then I like to kind of take a look at what I'm doing. I have several paintings going on at the same time in the studio. So I'm looking at, you know, the light conditions and seeing what's going on. And I'm trying to make a decision of what, I like to go from painting to painting. I like to have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I think today I want to get that fold. I want to nail that shape or that shadow. And over here, I think I'd like to let this sit, but I'm going to, you know, I like to let paintings, you know, I like to come back to them, let them sit and let them and look at them. The one nice, I have a very large studio, and the nice thing about it is I can get a lot of distance. So sometimes I'll just far away, and I'll stand back, and I'll just really look at it. And I'll look at it with my study, maybe close up, and just see how it's reading. You know, I do a lot of that, a lot of back and forth and a lot of looking at. And then there's a lot of prep in the with the pigments, picking out which pigments, picking out, you know, which colors I think I'm going to be working with and arranging all that. And then sometimes just a little sketching, you know, just any.
Uh-huh.
I still have those big newsprint pads and just get the hand moving.
Mm-hmm.
I could just open a book. So it could be, you know, Roy Lichtenstein, or it could be Neil Welliver. So I'll just look at something and just do a sketch of what they were doing. And it just gets the hand going.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful teacher from the Bauhaus was Johannes Itten. Have you ever read anything by him?
Yes. Yes. Another color legend.
Isn't that great?
Yes. Oh my God. And it's been so long since I've read this stuff. I don't know. I'm like, right now, as we're talking, I'm just like kind of like vibrating with the urge to like go get those books.
And it's just like, it's a great old friend. I remember when I found The Art of Color at Cornell when I was 20 years old, and I was just blown away. I was so happy to find that book.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like I remember when I actually didn't know that I wanted to be an art, or I did know that I wanted to be an artist, or that painting was going to be a part of my life, but I didn't know that I was going to make a career out of it until like in my 20s. And one thing that happened was I just made a very immature decision about what school I was going to go to and based it entirely on location and nothing else. And I got to the school, realized it was the wrong one. And at the time I was interested in pre-med. And so I was taking those classes. And when I realized it was the wrong school, I was like, oops. Okay. So I'm not going to stay, but if I leave, I'm going to lose all my scholarships. So I'm going to just fill the next semester entirely with art classes. And one of the classes that I took was color theory. And I'm telling you this story because I'm staring at your collages and then the equivalent painting. And one of the exercises that we did that I loved so much that made me decide right then and there that I was going to study art was, I think, torture for everybody else in the class. Like, the instructor made us make a collage out of cut out from magazines, and you know, she's like, try to get, you know, like pieces with big swatches of color, like don't do gradations and stuff like that. But she didn't tell us why we were doing this. And so I made this insanely intricate collage, and then we turned that in. And then the next thing she says is like, okay, now you're going to do a painting of that collage and you're going to mix all of your colors from the primaries and nothing else. And not only are you going to do a painting of that, but I want you, when you mix the color, I want you to test it by put that color onto the collage that you made, and you shouldn't be able to see it.
Excellent.
And then you can start painting. I loved that so much. Like, I was in heaven. I was like obsessed with it. I don't know how many hours I took on it, but I loved that so much. And that kind of started my love affair with color and Albers and Eaton and all this. And so as I'm looking at your work, I just keep thinking of that exercise and I'm like, ooh, this looks like so much fun.
You know, that's really interesting because in terms of what you were doing, you bring that back into your work. For instance, what I'll do sometimes when I'm painting, you know, and I've mixed a color mm-hmm. from study and I'm working on the painting, I will sometimes at the end of the painting session take these like woodblock pieces of paper. They're only like 8x10, but you know, you can palette knife off your pigment, your mixture.
Uh-huh.
These sheets that take the oil paint.
Oh.
Yeah. So I just do sheets of those and let them dry, and I use them for subsequent as little background elements for subsequent collage studies and stuff, because you're building, you know, color notes.
Oh my gosh.
And not just throwing out the paint. And then another thing that's triggering me, the response to what you were saying, is when you're making collages also, you know, if you put an element down like on a gesso board or on, you know, a piece of paper that can take some paint next to it, it's either prepared in some way or you can take the oil. And you can mix to one of the elements, which is nice, because once you've learned that, achieve that color mastery, you can say, I want to pick up from, say, that part of the fold or that mountain or whatever, and you mix the color, and then you put it right into your collage study. You're already orchestrating it, you know, you're already making it yours, because you're creating a new ground. You're taking this element out of whatever context it was in, whatever magazine or wherever, and
right
you're integrating it into your pictorial space. So I think it's very exciting too.
Yeah, and you're reminding me also of another class that I had in college that was just about experimentation with materials. And now I can't remember what it is, but you know, if you buy plexiglass, there's always a sheet of plastic on top of it that you have to peel off. Somebody out there probably knows the name of this material, but whatever it is, it's that thing. But acrylic paint won't stick to it. So you can mix a whole bunch of acrylic paint and put it onto that surface. And then when it dries, you can just peel it off.
Oh, how cool.
And I would use that to make collages too.
You've given me something new.
Somebody, like, I'm sure you don't have to buy a piece of plexiglass to get that plastic, but whatever that plastic is, and I know there's a name for it, somebody is either going to put it in the comments, they're going to go, oh, I know what that is, and say, or I'll find it for you. But whatever that is, acrylic won't stick to it.
That is so neat. There's also, you know, in terms of how to get those effects, it's so sometimes just color transparency, color off of rolls, you know, is it clear, but it has like a tint to it.
Uh-huh.
It could be like photography, you know, filter, color filters or whatever. I just like to take those and cut them and put them over a figure ground sort of section of it. And then you can see you're actually getting a transparency effect.
Right.
Then you can mix that color, you know, mix it in oils, which, so you're kind of playing back and forth.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So much fun.
Yeah. I mean, so a lot of my time, I have these large tables in my studio. They're just basically, all they are is like very heavy plywood on horses.
Uh-huh.
Like 4x8 plywood. So I give myself a lot of space to just put out the books, put out the elements, put out whatever you're playing with, and, you know, just kind of play around with it. And that stuff can, you can just, it's wonderful because you cut something out, throw it on a color, kind of walk back later and the light's changing. You go, hey, wait a minute, that was good. You know, you can just kind of play around and just let them sit on the table. And I found, I've developed some of my best paintings doing that, just having large layout area, giving yourself enough
space
to just have all your stuff.
It gives you the opportunity to have those, I don't know, happy accidents, insights. I don't know what it is. Like you can walk away and come back later and have a refreshed mind and see it. Or like you said, the light changes.
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing about the difference between, I was just thinking about this morning, between drawing and working collage style. With collage materials, you know, you have a ground, you know, something you're playing against something else. So it's a very giving kind of thing. There's a lot of play element to it. And drawing, it's much more of a performance thing of your body. You know, it's much more of your arm, your hand showing, the actual gesture
of
who you are. So I'm doing it. What I'm always trying to think of is how to have that balance, because I don't want it just to be the satisfaction of the collage work, and I don't want it just to be the drawing on the canvas. You know, there's always this kind of wanting to somehow get more gesture into a collage,
uh-huh,
or more of the color into the drawing. You know, I think we all as artists deal with that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but it's almost like, I don't mean to demean collage work, but it's almost like doing a collage is sort of like putting together a puzzle.
Yeah, I think the drawing is really important. I think that in terms of knowledge, in terms of your gesture, and in terms of, I tend to draw very, you know, it's very weird. I mean, I've always almost drawn photographically. You know what I mean? I draw and I look at something, I can just nail it.
Very accurate in your,
it's just strong draftings. You know, I can mm-hmm, nail it. But so for me, it's more finding the forms I like and going, you know, I think if you've been painting and drawing for a long time, you start hopefully kind of going with your strengths and the aspects that give you, you know, the most feedback, the most empowered with in terms of making mm-hmm, a statement. So I think that you don't feel that you have to learn so much as you have to know what you like, know what to go for.
Right.
Otherwise it can be, collage can be a dangerous medium. Because there's so much can become kind of, I see a lot of collage work that's just, it was fun, but it's just no rhyme or reason. You know what I mean? It's just not, it's not engaging me in any pictorial sense. It might be kind of fun. It might kind of have a narrative story going on, but pictorially it's not hanging together for me.
Yeah. It doesn't hold the interest. Like it's kind of like somebody once equated painting to doing a magic trick. Which sounds kind of weird, but when you think about it, like what holds people's interest about painting is that it leaves them with questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you can look at a painting and you know, it's kind of like you see the hand movement, you know how the trick was done.
Yeah.
You don't have any more questions and you're just kind of like, oh, okay, I get it. And I think collage is a bit more dangerous, like you're saying, in that sense, to fall into that, not leave any questions.
Exactly. I think with paint, you know, painting in the hand and the knitting together, the making of the surface, the time element, it's just, paint has it's a visceral thing. I think that's why paintings, you know, have to be seen in person. But, you know, I can look at so much art online but I know if there's something I want to see, I've got to go see it, you know?
Yes.
Got to go see it. Like I the Tiepolo show I saw in 1997 at the Met, that was a big trigger for me. The Picasso retrospective way back in the 80s I loved Picasso in high school because of his gesture, because of his drawing, you know? But when I went into New York and saw his work, it was exciting to me, physically exciting.
Yeah.
growing up and being able to see paintings, and when you know that they're special to you, what is that? It is magical. A painting stays with you so much longer than other things. For me, it does.
Right. Yeah, you're just reminding me of something Jillian said about going to the museum when she was young. And
yeah, that was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And being really moved by the painting. And I don't know, I imagine most artists have had this experience where you maybe have seen a painting in a book and then you see it in real life. And it still surprises me sometimes when I think that I've seen enough art and I think that I know what's coming is the right word, but I'm always surprised when I see something in person and it's like, I almost want to, I'm like controlling my emotions and trying not to cry just by, because here's this piece and this art, like, you know, like it's such an emotional, and it surprises me every single time that I'll go in and I'll see a painting and I just am overwhelmed by being in front of that painting.
I know. I remember going to I've always loved Veronese.
Uh-huh.
Especially after kind of my thing with Tiepolo. So I went to London in 2000 to the National Gallery.
Uh-huh.
And I'd seen Veronese in books and stuff like that. And I'd seen a couple of his pieces at the Frick and stuff. But this large Veronese, and it was, you know, 30 by 50 feet. I forget how big the painting was. I took out my sketchbook and I sat on a bench in the National Gallery. First of all, I almost cried. It was so beautiful. And I spent the day drawing it. It was in natural light in the National Gallery. And the light was changing throughout the whole afternoon as I was drawing.
Oh, wow.
It was one of the best experiences in terms of feeling a painting, you know, and just looking at the sheer, you know, scale and beauty of it.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing experience. I'm trying to think, the MoMA. I used to love the MoMA, the original MoMA, when you could kind of walk it, you know, it didn't have all the escalators and stuff yet. It was the original room. And you could actually walk up to Guernica, or hardly anyone would be around. You could just kind of sit and look at the paintings and Monet's water lilies or anything just for, you know, a couple hours by yourself.
I know. I think now if you did that, they would kick you out.
And those experiences stay with you.
Yeah.
There's a few things I've had to go see. Oh, I saw a really fascinating show, really good. Carrie James Marshall.
I don't know her.
He's actually a Chicago-based artist. He's now about 67 years old. And he did these really large collage paintings. And then in his later years, he's done some beautiful portraits. But it's at the Whitney Museum if you want to see some interesting evolution of a painter. He's interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. I'll have to see it online right now, but
I missed the Stuart Davis show at the downtown. I wanted to see that. But there's always something every month or so, you know, that I've got to go see.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you need a painting fix, you know?
I know. I think that I need like painting pilgrimages, you know, to go sit in front of paintings for hours at a time, where like that's my one and only thing that I'm going to go do. Like I would love to just go to the Prado and just go to Madrid for the sole reason of going to the Prado.
Me too. I've got to do that sometime. You know, I haven't, it's not crazy, but I can't believe I haven't yet. I've got the Prado book, you know, it's right in the library, and I'm familiar with most of the artists in the Prado, but I haven't not gone to the Prado. Silly.
Yeah. And you're making me want to jump on an airplane and go to New York and just go to the Met for like a week straight. And
yeah, exactly.
Do nothing else.
Yeah.
Well, Ginny, it has been so wonderful to talk to you. And thank you so much. I love this conversation.
I think we have a lot in common having talked to you.
I know. Me too. I feel like halfway through, I'm like, I feel like I've known you for years or something. So it's great.
Great. Great to talk to you. And real pleasure, because as I said earlier, it's this community. We're all working alone in our studios, and I think it's really wonderful that you're doing this, and you know, different voices, and I've enjoyed listening to the other artists quite a bit.
Thank you.
Take care.
I want to give a big thank you to Ginny for sharing her insights and being so generous with her time and knowledge. Also, I'd like to thank Jillian Peterson Cragg for making this conversation possible by connecting me with Ginny. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast link. You'll find show notes for the episodes there. You can see Ginny's paintings along with links to connect with her and links to everything that we talked about in this episode. Ginny sent me a list of the books that we talked about, and after an email exchange about Albertson Itten, she was kind enough to send links with her recommendation of which books in particular to get. There are many editions and reprints, so it can get confusing. Because of the nature of these books, particularly the Joseph Albers book, they can get really, really pricey. You'll want one that has excellent print quality. The colors need to be accurate to the original, otherwise it totally defeats the purpose. But high quality printing is super expensive. So for example, if the Joseph Albers book were available today as he originally printed it, it would probably be around $1,000. Current editions, though, use different printing processes and range from like 10 to 200. So I always kind of wonder about the quality of the printing of the higher priced edition. And Ginny recommends an edition that's in the mid-range, if you're wondering. And I want to thank her again for her generosity in helping me with that research, because I think it's super, super helpful. And if you're at all interested in color, you should definitely look into these books. So again, those links are in the show notes for this episode at savvypainter.com. Click on the podcast tab in the menu and you can see Ginny's episode right there. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helps several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how 3 artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Next week, Deborah Zlotsky will be my guest on the Savvy Painter podcast. So until then, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.